Hello, this is Terrence McNally. In light of the Cohen and Manafort verdicts and the overturning of Obama's clean air policy regarding power plant emissions, let's listen to my 2005 conversation with Jared Diamond regarding his book Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed. In it, he asks what caused some of the great civilizations of the past to collapse into ruin, and what can we learn from their fates? Welcome, Jared Diamond. Thank you for letting us into your home.
Thank you, and it's nice to be with you today.
Could we give the audience some sense of your personal path? For instance, how do you even describe what it is you do and how your work evolved over the years?
Today, I would describe myself as a geographer and environmental historian interested in large-scale questions about human societies. But I began at age 7 as a bird watcher, and then for about 40 years from the 1950s until 2002, I was the world's expert on the gallbladder. I taught medical students, and my specialty was laboratory physiology. But on the side, I've been pursuing careers in New Guinea bird, evolutionary biology, and increasingly human environmental history. Till today, I would describe myself as a geographer.
I noticed, yeah, your department at UCLA has shifted over the years, hasn't it?
That's right. I was hired by UCLA in the physiology department of the medical school, and it was only in 2002 that I switched to our college.
Okay, I want to go back to Guns, Germs, and Steel, and I'm just going to read a quote that you said there. You said, "I've set myself the modest task of trying to explain the broad pattern of human history on all the continents for the last 13,000 years. Before we talk about collapse, could you briefly tell us the big lessons of the earlier book?"
The big question and then the big lesson. The big question was why history has unfolded so differently for people of different continents over the last 13,000 years. That's to say, why Europeans ended up conquering or in some cases exterminating or driving out peoples of other continents rather than, say, Aboriginal Australians or Africans or Native Americans conquering Europeans. So that was the question. The answer was that it had nothing to do with Europeans themselves or any people. It wasn't a matter of somebody being smarter than anybody else, but it had to do with differences in the environment, different environmental resources, particularly differences in the plants and animals available for domestication in particular parts of the world that triggered the start of farming, which then triggered the start of states and technology and kingdoms. So that was the question, and the message is it's location, location, location.
Okay. And your previous books, the two that I know are The Third Chimpanzee and Why Is Sex Fun? Fabulous title, I must say. It seems that Guns, Germs, and Steel raised the bar. What was it that made you suddenly say, I'm going to take on that?
It wasn't sudden. It's a question that's been on my mind, had been on my mind for nearly 40 years before I wrote Guns, Germs, and Steel. After all, I've done a lot of field work on the island of New Guinea, near Australia, where live the largest number of people in the modern world who until recently were using stone tools. So New Guineans are so-called primitive people, technologically primitive. I've been working there for a long time, and I went out naive, thinking that they were primitive in their brains, and it took me about one day to realize that these are really smart people. Why did they end up with the stone tools? Or why, and then why more generally, did Europeans end up enslaving Africans instead of Africans enslaving Europeans? So the question has been on my mind for a long time. After I wrote my first book for the public, The Third Chimpanzee, and then I wanted to do a purpose-written book on a unified subject, I realized that now I'm ready to tackle this biggest question of human history.
One of the things that it seems is that you just finished that saying, human history. You start out as a scientist, and these books, Collapse and Guns, Germs, and Steel, really are sort of making history a science, when even historians will usually say it's an art. How do you weave the two together?
I would first say that when historians say that history is an art, they're wrong or they're underselling their discipline. As for how I weave them together, many areas of science are what are called historical sciences. We tend to think of science as laboratory science where you got test tubes and controlled experiments. And yes, that's true for chemistry and molecular biology. But there are whole areas of science that you can't pursue in the laboratory. For example, they have to do with the past. Dinosaurs, you don't have a test tube, one with a big dinosaur and the other with a blue dinosaur. Or astronomy, you don't turn stars on and off. Or geology, you don't start and stop glaciers. These are historical sciences. As a scientist then, particularly as an evolutionary biologist, I'm used to finding out about the real world, and that's what science is, under circumstances where you can't do experiments. So for me, human history, it's just another historical science.
Collapse. What was it that called to you about that book, and what did you hope to accomplish?
Collapse, called to me about Collapse was romantic interests going back to when I was in my 20s and began reading Thor Heyerdahl's books about the settlement of Easter Island and the great stone statues and how they were erected and why they were overthrown. So I think all of us go through this teenage and early 20s stage of romantic interest in collapsed societies like, the Maya cities in the Yucatan. Again, it's a question that's been on my mind for a long time. After I had written Guns, Germs, and Steel and was thinking of what next to write about, it also happened that archaeologists for the last 15 or 20 years have finally been learning about these collapsed societies and have been starting to understand why the Mayan, the Anasazi, and the Easter Islanders collapsed. So after finishing Guns, Germs, and Steel, it was obvious this was the next book.
So there have been actually recent discoveries, recent learning that made this book more possible than it might have been 20 years ago?
That's right. 20 years ago, we really didn't know what had happened on Easter Island, why the islanders ended up in this barren landscape overthrowing their statues. And it really also wasn't clear why the Maya had apparently died out in large numbers and abandoned their great cities. But thanks to archaeological excavations, we now have better understanding of these collapses, and it's now possible to write, a unified book on collapses.
You put forth a five-point framework of factors that tend to contribute to collapse. Could you tell us what they are? And I think it'd be great if you could do it in terms of Easter Island or Pitcairn Island or both, so that it's not just intellectual, but it's what happened to these actual people.
Sure. Five-point framework. I tend to go in for five-point frameworks, and people might make fun of me by saying, whatever you ask Jared, he'll have a five-point framework for it. And in some ways, it's true. I don't go for simple one-factor explanations. But at the same time, I'm not a person who comes up with a laundry list of 73 factors. Yes, you can always come up with a more complicated explanation, but that doesn't get you anywhere. So I try to find a modest number of the most important factors. Instead of taking Easter Island, because the Easter Island collapse involved mainly two factors, or Pitcairn, whose collapse involved mainly three factors, let's take a full five-factor collapse. And this involves a European society. Collapses happen not just to exotic people like Polynesians or Native Americans. They happen to blue-eyed, blonde-haired Europeans like Norwegians, the Vikings who went out and settled Greenland around AD 1000, and they built cathedral and stone churches, and they wrote Latin, and they were literate, and they wrote in runes, until after about 500 years, they were all dead. So you might say, here's a failure of a society. But the Greenland Norse lasted longer in Greenland than Europeans have lasted in North America today. Their collapse involved all five factors on the checklist. Number one, human environmental impacts. Many societies damage their environment, unwittingly destroy the environmental resources on which they depend. And that happened with the Greenland Norse. They chopped down their forests in order to clear land for pastures and to have firewood and construction timber, but that resulted in erosion that gradually removed land that could have been used for productive pastures, number one. Number two, climate change. We have climate change today that we are causing, but in the past the climate has naturally gotten colder or hotter or rainier or drier. In the case of the Greenland Norse, the climate got colder, and if you're trying to grow hay to feed your cattle, and it's colder, you can grow less hay, which means less hay to get your cattle through the winter, and your cattle may start dying. Number
now,
two.
Let me ask you on the climate change. Was it a decade, 20 years? Was it? I mean, we're talking now in dealing with global warming about something which we think may last a while. Was this? I imagine once you're vulnerable, it doesn't take a long time to cause real crises.
In the case in the Greenland Norse, the climate was in their favor for about the first 300 years, from AD 1000 to 1300. It started turning against them in the mid-1300s when one of their two settlements died out. And then in the course of a few decades in the 1400s, it turned badly against them and the other settlement died out. So there were three factors. There are two factors, human environmental impacts, climate going against you. Third factor is enemies. If you are starting to get weak because of climate change or your environmental impact, most societies have enemies, and many societies can fight off their enemies until the society gets weakened for whatever reason, like the Roman Empire getting weakened and then getting overrun by barbarians. In the case of the Greenland Norse, as they got weakened, they had their enemies, the Inuit or Eskimos, who probably played a role in exterminating them. Factor number four, friends. If you have friends who get in trouble and you depend on those friends for essential resources, they're your trade partners. For example, the 1973 Gulf oil crisis in the United States. It's not that the U.S. had a homegrown crisis. We had the misfortune to be dependent on some fragile countries in the Gulf for essential resources, namely oil. And the Greenland Norse depended upon Norway for essential resources, particularly iron and timber, and then cultural identity. But Norway began to decline, and the trade from Norway to Greenland was impeded by sea ice. So there's number four. And then number five, every society responds or fails to respond to its problems. The Greenland Norse failed to respond successfully. So five factors for the Greenland Norse.
Let's go through them again.
Yeah. Environmental impact, in their case, deforestation and soil erosion, number one. Number two, climate change, in their case, natural cooling. Today, it's human-induced warming. Number three, enemies for the Greenland Norse, the Inuit. For the United States today, plenty of enemies overseas. Number four, friendly trade partners for the Greenland Norse, the Norwegians, for the United States, all those countries that supply us with oil and metals and other essential supplies. And number five, how you respond or fail to respond to the threats that you face. And the United States faces big threats today, and we have reason to be concerned whether we're responding appropriately.
Right, we'll write that chapter later. With the Norse, that final one, the failure to respond, that I find a very interesting analysis. What happened there?
It is a very interesting question. Why a society doesn't even notice or doesn't successfully respond to problems that you would think are obvious. For example, the Greenland Norse, chopping down all the trees and causing soil erosion. You would think not a good idea for people who need timber and need pastures. How could they be so dumb? But let's just suppose that 50 years from now, there are still people left on Earth and there's still a complex society. What do you think people 50 years from now are going to say when they look back on the United States in 2005 with its well-known energy problems and they see us continuing to waste energy and not dealing with our population problems and not addressing our water problems, how obvious, our soil problems, how obvious, our climate change problems, how utterly obvious. So there are lots of reasons why societies are either willfully blind to obvious problems or don't notice problems which in hindsight are obvious but at the time aren't so obvious.
Well, in their case, you point out that they could have learned a great deal from the Inuit who preceded and outlasted them, but were unwilling to.
That's right. They were, we would say, willfully blind. Here are these other people in Greenland, the Eskimos or the Inuit, who in fact survived. They're still alive today. So it's like one of these controlled laboratory experiments. Right. The red test tube and the blue test tube, the Inuit and the Greenland Norse, they have different societies. The Greenland Norse have a pasturing society growing sheep and goats and cows, but refusing to hunt whales and seals. Whereas the Inuit are hunting whales and seals. It seems obvious if you are short of food during the winter, it's a good idea to hunt whales and seals. How could the Norse be so stupid and not learn from the Inuit? Well, the Greenland Norse were medieval Christians. They despised these other people, the Inuit, the pagans. Well, modern Americans have also been known to despise some other people in the past. Think of Pearl Harbor, and there are people today of whom we hold a low opinion. The Greenland Norse held a low opinion and refused to learn from the Inuit, even though they all ended up dead as a result.
Right, right. I know there's a thing where they wouldn't eat fish, right?
They wouldn't. Not only would they not hunt whales and hunt seals, but the most obvious thing, the main export of Greenland today is fish. My first night in Greenland, my first night in the youth hostel, I'm in the kitchen of the youth hostel, and into the kitchen walks this 23-year-old beautiful blonde Danish tourist with two big char, weighing about 2 pounds, and she's caught them not with a fancy rod and reel. She saw these fish in a pond, in a trapped pool, in a river. She grabbed them with her hands. So it doesn't take high technology to catch big fish in Greenland. But the Greenland Norse didn't eat fish. On the other hand, we Americans don't eat goats, as Mexicans do. We don't eat frogs, as the French do. We don't eat spiders and rats, as my New Guinea friends do. We don't eat horses, as the Irish used to do. Now, we're not starving as a result of this, but someday, who knows?
Let's move to another civilization, the Anasazi of the Southwest in the U.S. You point out that they lasted quite a long time, and I notice, as you just did with the Norse, that they lasted longer than Europeans have been in America. But the Anasazi, you point out, lasted a long time in a very inhospitable environment. Is there something to learn from their success as well as their failure?
Interesting question. Things to learn from their success include that societies that master difficult environments for a long time, it's not a guarantee of lasting forever. And for example, in the case of the U.S. Southwest, the Anasazi, who built the great cities, these were the tallest skyscrapers in North America until Chicago in the 1870s. They thrived in the U.S. Southwestern desert and parts of New Mexico and Arizona, where nobody is making a living by agriculture today. That was quite a success story. Eventually, they and other Native American societies in the same area succumbed to problems, particularly of climate change and human environmental impacts. But there was one group of Native Americans who got a solution that worked. They were the Pueblo Indians. They devised a strategy of living in large settlements, living not in the floodplain, but a little above the floodplain, developing a mixed economy. And the Pueblo Indians have been carrying on successfully in this difficult environment for something like 600 years. And so when I was in the U.S. Southwest in the Anasazi area, I was quoted what Pueblo Indians today say about Europeans, particularly when the wonders of modern technology are pointed out to them. And Pueblo Indians say, we were here long before you came, and we expect still to be here long after you are gone.
One of the things that it seems to me happens is that in the good times, people eat well, populations grow, societies become more complex, and that larger, more complex, more comfortable society is less able to respond if bad times come. Is that That accounts, I mean, that happens often, yes?
That happens often, like today, for example, like regularly in the past, in the case of the Anasazi, as of the Maya and the Easter Islanders. Yes, when times were good, when there was plenty of rainfall, then they occupied marginal lands that previously had been too dry, but when there's plenty of rain, they can settle there. They increase their population, and that's fine as long as the weather conditions are good. But then when it gets dry again, they find themselves with this large population that they now can no longer support. They can't just retract to the floodplains because there are too many people to occupy the floodplains. Take the United States and the world today. So we got 6.5 billion people, and there are plenty of people today who say, well, 6.5 billion, at the rate at which the world is going now, our population will build up to only 9 billion, 9.5 billion. So the world is in the process of solving its population problems. Well, solving its population problems with the climate turning against us, with global warming and with climate in many parts of the world getting drier. We're having difficulties today feeding 6.5 billion people. There are, what, 1 billion people today or 2 billion who are close to the starvation level. What are we going to do when we've got another 3 billion people a few decades from now?
Yeah, that you when you get fatter as a society when the land is rich, but then you have to deal with the contraction. Do you know the book the fellow who wrote Brian Quinn or Daniel Quinn?
Daniel Quinn.
One of his books, which I haven't read, but I've spoken to Daniel about, is the one in which he says that it's dangerous to try to solve starvation problems. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
Is that his book, Ishmael, by any chance?
No, Ishmael is a happier book in a way. Plan B, I think, is the one where he says, you know, when we export food aid to starving countries, we actually create a problem down the road.
Wow. That is a difficult and painful question. All right, so there are people starving in the Sudan and lots of other places. And it is not nice when people are starving. So those countries like the United States and Canada and Argentina that produce food surpluses export food to countries where people are starving. And yet there are people who would say, what good does it do to export food to countries where people are starving? Because the dilemma of Malthus, the British economist and demographer Malthus of about 200 years ago, Malthus said that you're never going to solve the world's problems just by producing more food. When there's more food, people will reproduce to eat the available food, and you will have conditions of starvation again. But it would be unconscionable for the United States and Canada not to export food. What is more unconscionable is for us not to be willing to export the know-how and the knowledge to enable people who would like to limit their populations to limit their populations.
Yeah, exactly. Let's turn to another one, the Maya. And I was surprised to learn in your book the enormous population. I believe estimates are from 5 to 50 million people. And it was a total shock to me that it was, you know, perhaps the size of the population of California. You know, what I'd always thought was a quaint civilization with a few pyramids, you know. Did that enormous population, was that a factor in their demise?
It was. This quaint population that made a few pyramids, as you say, was on a par with modern California, which 100 years from now will look like that quaint population no bigger than the Maya that made a few skyscrapers but didn't pay attention to the problems they were getting into. In the case of the Maya, yes, their population grew. They suffered from problems of climate change. Their population grew when there was enough rain for them to grow corn to feed 15 million Maya, maybe 50 million Maya. And then there was climate change. It got drier. They had also been chopping down their forests, like the Anasazi and the Easter Islanders, and causing soil erosion. And then came a drought. When the drought came, they could no longer feed the 50 million people or even the 15 million people. The estimates now are that the population of the Maya in the course of the drought shrank by something like 90%. If they started out 50 million, they lost 45 million through some combination of starvation and fighting each other and not reproducing in numbers comparable to the death rate. But by the time it was all over, the great Maya cities that today we go to visit as tourists, the great Maya cities had been abandoned. They got overgrown by jungle, with the result that when Cortes in the 1500s marched through the Yucatan Peninsula, through the Maya heartland, Cortes didn't know that he was 2 miles from what had been the great city of Tikal, because it was overgrown by jungle and there was nothing for Cortes to see. What's going to happen 70 years from now when some extraterrestrials march past what had been Los Angeles?
Right. And just with a little bit of global warming, Manhattan, the ground zero, which we consecrate now as the site of 9/11, is one of the ones that will go underwater quickest as the sea rises.
That's true of Manhattan. It's also true of say, Florida. Much of Florida is how many feet above sea level? Another 5 feet of sea level rise in global warming, or the Netherlands. One-third of the Netherlands is already up to 23 feet below sea level rise, so it's 28 feet below sea level. Or there are many Pacific islands that are now 2 or 3 feet above sea level. When the sea is 5 feet higher, there's no way that those poor Pacific islands are going to be able to build dikes like the Dutch did.
Speaking of Pacific Islanders, because Easter Island in some ways is such a romantic notion of those huge statues, even though they may be a 1 or 2 factor demise, could you tell people what happened to them?
Yeah. Easter Island, of all the societies whose collapses I describe in my book, my experience has been that Easter Island is the collapse that grabs people most, because it was simplest and just so visible. Easter Island is the most remote habitable scrap of land in the world. It's an island about 2,000 miles off the coast of Chile, to the west in the Pacific Ocean, and it's about 1,500 miles east of the nearest Polynesian island. It's known for these gigantic stone statues, statues up to 70 feet tall and weighing up to 270 tons. The islanders dragged these stone statues up to 12 miles, and they erected them into a vertical position. But these are people, they don't have machines, they don't have wheels, they don't have draft animals. Somehow, using just human muscle power, they dragged these statues and tilted them upright. So how do they do it? But when Europeans arrived on Easter Island in 1722, there were no trees. And yet you can be sure that whatever they did to transport and erect these statues, it required trees for timber or for sleds or for some sledges and levers. So where were the trees? But the island had no trees. I mentioned that we could not understand these collapses of societies until archaeological discoveries of the last 20 years, and Easter Island is a good example. Archaeologists and paleontologists, people who study extinct plant and animal communities, discovered that Easter Island, today this treeless landscape, when Polynesians arrived in 8800, was covered by a subtropical forest, including the world's biggest palm tree. And the Polynesians began to chop down trees for all the usual reasons. They chopped down trees to clear land for gardens and to have canoes to go fishing and harpoon tuna and dolphins. And then then also they chopped down trees to have timber for constructing houses and to have the sleds and levers for erecting statues. And they continued to chop down trees until around the year 1670, they chopped down the last tree on the island, at which point they didn't have any wood for sleds or levers, so they couldn't transport and erect statues. But in addition, without forests to protect the soil, they ran into problems of soil erosion. They couldn't construct canoes to go fishing, so they didn't have big sources of meat and protein. The only large animal left on Easter Island, now that they can't harpoon tuna and dolphins, the only large animal as a source of meat is people.
Each other.
And Easter Island society collapsed in an epidemic of cannibalism. The worst insult that an Easter Islander in those days, if you wanted to make someone else really furious, you would say to them, "The flesh of your mother sticks between my teeth." That's this epidemic of cannibalism. Easter Island society collapsed due ultimately to deforestation.
Now, one thing I hear, if people caught that, was 50 years between the collapse and the arrival of Europeans. I mean, it wasn't that it happened, long ago. I mean, but for a few years there, they might have been salvaged.
Well, but for a few years, would Europeans have salvaged them?
Yeah, right. Unfortunately, they would have probably eaten.
The European track record of what Europeans have done to Polynesians and other people is not a salvaging record.
I've heard that you were originally going to start the book, Collapse, with Easter Island, because it's the one that, as we said, is romantic and mysterious and so on. But in fact, the book starts in Montana. Now, how did you make that choice, and what does that mean to you?
Originally, you're correct that the first chapter of my book, Collapse, was the chapter on Easter Island, because Easter is the story that grabs people. But then I realized, if I begin the book with Easter Island, and then I go on to the Mayan Anasazi, my readers will get the idea, these past societies did it. These, let's face it, these dumb Polynesians and these Native Americans doing stupid things that we smart Americans with our technology, we would never do such stupid things. And so the book instead begins with a chapter on Montana, of all the states in the United States. My family and I spend parts of our summers in Montana. Montana is considered the most pristine state in the lower 48. Something more than half of the area of Montana is forest, national and state forest. It's got a low population. So you would think that Montana is the state with the fewest ecological problems, right, fewest environmental problems. But scratch the surface in Montana, you find all of the problems. Global warming. Because of global warming, the snowpack that provides the water for the irrigation agriculture in Montana, the snowpack is melting. In 20 years, Glacier National Park will have no glaciers, so Montana won't have irrigation agriculture. Montana has problems of soil erosion and salinization, destruction of soil by too much salt. In eastern Montana, it has probably the worst problems in the United States of toxic wastes, because Montana was the copper mining state, and as a legacy of 130 years of copper mining, Montana has just terrible problems of toxic waste, copper and arsenic and acid in its streams. Montana has problems of what else? Introduced pest species, weeds, introduced weeds, these tiny little seeds have spread. And the state of Montana now spends a couple of $100 million every year trying to control the weeds. This is just, and Montana has problems of increasing problems of population in certain parts of Montana. So I begin my book with what seems to be the most pristine part of the richest country in the world, but you look at Montana carefully and you find all of the problems that bother these remote romantic people like Easter Islanders and Anasazi.
Right.
Hello, this is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my 2005 conversation with Jared Diamond regarding this book, Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed.
One of the things that I noticed in several of the cases was that the ruling classes seem to fatten up in good times when everybody has plenty to eat, and the rituals and the politics and the religious elites and so on. But when hard times hit, people seem less willing to indulge in their political and their religious power trips and so on. Where do you think we are?
Well, in looking at past societies and then thinking where we are today, as I came towards the end of work on my book, literally within the last couple of months, I asked myself, what are the deep lessons? What are the societies in the past that succeeded and those that failed? And what is it that differentiated the success stories? There were societies that succeeded, like Iceland and Japan and the New Guinea Highlands. Why did they succeed while the Anasazi and the Mayan and the Easter Islanders failed? And I realized that a difference is that in the successful societies, the elite, the governing elite, could not or did not insulate themselves from the problems of the rest of society. Instead, they suffered along with everybody else, and so they were exposed to the problems of society, and they were motivated to solve the problems. We were societies that fail, like the Maya and the Anasazi. The Maya kings were in their palaces, and you can ask, why didn't they look out the window and they see the deforestation on the hillside? But the Maya kings were taxing the commoners, and the Maya kings were still eating very well, even while the commoners were getting malnourished and starving. And the Maya kings continued to eat well until the Maya masses were in such bad shape that they overthrew the kings and burned the palaces of the kings. You can then ask yourself, in the United States today, what's happening with the elite? Are our elite embedded within the rest of society and suffering the problems of the rest of society. But instead, here we sit in Southern California. Within the last 10 years in California, we've had an increasing phenomenon of what's called the gated community in California, in which rich people do their very best to insulate themselves from the problems of the rest of society. And they do it literally by living behind gates, behind fences, where instead of worrying about the municipal water supply, they drink bottled water. Instead of worrying about the public police force, they've got their private security guards.
They don't go to public schools.
They don't go to public schools, but instead they put the money for their children into private schools. They're not worried about the Social Security system because they got their private pensions, and they're not worried about Medicare because they got their private health insurance. That is a blueprint for trouble when the elite are able to insulate themselves from the problems of society, because then they're not motivated to solve the problems the rest of society. And the elite can get away with it for a while. The elite in the United States can be able to get away with it for a while, just as the Maya elite did, but eventually they're not going to get away with it. Here in Los Angeles, we got the metaphor. I remember very well the 1993 riots in Los Angeles, when those riots in Los Angeles started in the poorer sections, and there was concern that poor people in Los Angeles were going to spill out of the poorer sections, and they were going to start pillaging in Beverly Hills and in Bel Air. And I remember very well, it was awful because we were out of town and we saw on television the flames and our kids. We knew that our kids were in a traffic jam here. Our kids were 6 years old at the time. What happened was that the police in Bel Air put up yellow plastic police tape across the roads entering Bel Air, the yellow plastic tape saying, "Don't come in here." Well, fortunately for the citizens of Bel Air, the people in the poorer sections did not crash through the police tape, but it would have been so easy to crash through the police tape. And for me, that was a metaphor that wealthy Americans would be utterly impotent. They couldn't keep out of their gated communities the people in poor areas once things get bad enough for the people of the poorer areas. Mm-hmm. So for the elite to insulate themselves, they can get away with it for a short time, but rich Americans aren't going to get away with it for very long.
Yeah, I think of a couple of things. One is that I guess when we have terrorist threats, we go to duct tape. So the elites here like tape as a form of protection. Another thing is that you'd think that democracy, the idea and the notion being that all people who vote have equal power and so on, and yet what we've seen over the last few years, again, is the elites isolating themselves, passing laws that act as if, you know, the bankruptcy law that recently passed protects very rich people who can set up asset protection and corporations and makes it tougher and tougher on the working people. It seems, as you say, as a recipe for real tragedy.
Yeah. I've wondered, people often ask me, are democracies more successful at solving their problems than dictatorships? Or vice versa, are dictatorships more successful? And when I compare the list of democracies and dictatorships, I don't see any generalizations. There are democracies that do very well. The Netherlands does remarkably well. Iceland does fantastically well. The United States so far has gotten away with it, but we have problems looming up. Among dictatorships, there are dictatorships that have made awful messes. Haiti is an example. Nepal, it looks as if it's degenerating into a dictatorship. The Maya were an affected dictatorship, so there were dictatorships that make mistakes.
Let me. I actually made the comment today when I was talking with someone about some of the notions in the book about how China has stopped deforestation. And my flip answer was, helps to be a dictator, you know. Tough to pass that law here.
You are right. That's an example of successes of dictatorships. There are successful and unsuccessful democracies, successful and unsuccessful dictatorships. You know, when you've got a dictatorship, you can take potent actions fast, and you can take potent bad actions and potent good actions. In the case of China, there were big floods in 1998. 240 million Chinese got affected or uprooted by
240 million?
240 million, one-fifth of the population of China got affected or uprooted by these floods. And the Chinese government, which is, let's put it frankly, something of a dictatorship, the government of China looked at these floods and said, this is really bad. What caused the floods? deforestation on the slopes meant that there wasn't the forest hold back the water on the slopes, and there was soil erosion. So the Chinese government said, enough of the deforestation. And they passed a law, bang, right there. There will be no more deforestation of old growth forest in China. That's what a dictatorship can do.
Yeah, lobbyists don't have much sway over there.
No.
Having brought ourselves to the current time, what are the choices? The book, the subtitle is How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed. I've seen you say there are two main choices that we have to make to succeed.
The broad choices are either solving our long-term problems and living happily ever after, or failing to solve our long-term problems, in which case certainly my children are going to have a life not worth living. The worst case scenario would be that the United States in the first world ends up with conditions like the third world, that the United States ends up with conditions like Somalia, where ecologically ravaged country where we sent in troops 14 years ago, or we end up with the conditions of the Philippines or Nepal or Afghanistan. That's to say, we become one more overpopulated, environmentally ravaged country. The problems that we face, they're obvious. They're the ones that people talk about all the time. They're the problems of population, climate change, water, forests, invasive species, soil, toxic chemicals, emerging diseases. There's no secret what the problems are, and there's no secret what we have to do to solve the problems, take them seriously.
What are the two crucial, you've pointed out there were two crucial things that need to happen to save us?
For the United States, the two overarching things would be for our elite not to save themselves and think that they can save themselves while everybody else goes down the tubes. It can work for a little while, it's not going to work forever. The elite have to think long-term about the rest of American society, and they have to think long-term about the other societies in the world. Just as the elite of the United States can't insulate themselves from the problems of the rest of the United States, we've known since September 11, 2001, that the United States can't insulate itself from the problems of these remote, ravaged countries like Afghanistan and Somalia and Iraq, because nowadays, remote countries have ways of creating problems for us. They can send terrorists. They can unconsciously send emerging diseases. They can send unstoppable waves of immigration. So that's one broad issue. And the other broad issue is reappraising deeply set values, again, among past societies. The ones that succeeded were ones that were willing to undertake these painful reappraisals, as Japan did with the Meiji Restoration, and as Europe has in the past 50 years in working towards the European Union and getting away from these nationalistic European states that have caused so much misery. And Europeans have realized in the past, okay, but after World War I and World War II, never again.
So let me read a couple of quotes. We need the courage to practice long-term thinking and to make bold, courageous, anticipatory decisions at a time when problems have become perceptible, but before they have reached crisis proportions. And then you say, we also need the courage to make painful decisions about values. Which of the values that formerly served a society well can continue to be maintained under new changed circumstances? Now, it seems to me that long-term thinking is almost a value. So it really seems that it boils down to a willingness to assess your values and shift. And yet if I look at America and, in some sense, even the world, there's a lot of powerful forces resisting changing values.
You are right. There are lots of powerful forces resisting changing values, but there are also powerful forces working towards changing values. For example, within the United States, an encouraging development is that the environmental movement didn't exist 50 years ago. The environmental movement virtually began with the publication of Rachel Carson's books in the 1950s. And so this movement that didn't exist 50 years ago, in the past 50 years, has gotten stronger and stronger. It's gaining in strength. That's an encouraging sign. Or there are plenty of people in the United States who are beginning to take seriously the problems of the rest of the world. Again, when I was born in 1937. I was born when the United States was isolationist. Mm-hmm. And we could afford to be isolationist. We didn't even enter World War I until 2 years after the beginning of World War I, because we thought that we could protect ourselves from Nazi Germany. But we could not protect ourselves from the combination of Nazi Germany and Japan.
World War II.
That was World War II. Yeah. After World War I, we relapsed into isolationism. After World War II, we did not relapse into isolationism, but for the last couple of decades, we've had the fantasy, what happens out there in Nepal and Indonesia and the Philippines? Yes, it's really sad for Nepal that they're deforesting, and now there is a Maoist uprising in Nepal, and the government is in a state of collapse, and that's very sad for the Nepalese, but what do the Nepalese mean for the United States? Well, the Nepalese mean for the United States what Somalia meant for the United States. 1991, the U.S. government realized we'd better send troops in there. Or the Nepal means what Afghanistan means for the United States. When people get unhappy, when the situation is desperate, when a country is poor and environmentally ravaged, when people get unhappy, every country has its crazy terrorists. The United States had its Theodore Kaczynski and its Timothy McVeigh. But the United States citizens are not desperate enough to support our Theodore Kaczynskis and our Timothy McVeigh. But you take a country like Afghanistan, people are desperate enough to support them. And when it happens in Afghanistan, the people of Afghanistan have a way of communicating their unhappiness nowadays to the United States. So we can no longer be isolationists.
Yeah, what I also see, though, is that there seems to be, whether it's the fundamentalist Muslims attacking on 9/11, or the kinds of morality or value fights that are going on in America right now, it seems that there's a digging in of the heels around don't touch my values. And what you're saying is that we're at a moment where if we're going to use long-term thinking and look ahead, it is time to reassess some of these values.
That's right, yeah. I would say we have serious problems. It's not the case that all of us are working toward solving those serious problems. There's a substantial fraction of us, whether it's 49% or 51%, that is not working at solving those serious problems. But we better solve those serious problems. We better start doing it yesterday. Because for many of them, in fact, for all of our serious problems, time is running out. For all of our serious problems, we've got between a few decades and 50 years. At the rate at which we're going now, at the rate of development of global warming, or at the rate of running out of fossil fuels, or at the rate of soil erosion, we have a couple of decades to get these problems under control, because if they're not under control in a couple of decades, much of the world is going to end up in the state of Somalia.
Now, one of the things that seems to me that's important in any system surviving is information flows. We may look at these primitive islanders and say, why couldn't they see? But we would think that with all the information and technology and so on that we have, we should be up to speed. Do you think the media, as constituted certainly in America right now, is so addicted to distraction that we're not getting the signals we need?
I would say that the media is my main, you are my main source for hope. People seriously often ask me, Jared, are you an optimist or a pessimist? And my answer is I'm a cautious optimist, namely that we've got problems, they're real, but the problems are soluble. And the reason why I'm cautiously optimistic is that we've got an enormous advantage that those Easter Islanders and the Maya did not have. And our enormous advantage is you, the media. Because we've got the media, we turn on our television sets in the morning and we see what happened today in Somalia and Afghanistan. So we got or in Nepal or Indonesia. We have the possibility to learn. But the Easter Islanders, when they were chopping down their last tree in 1670, they couldn't turn on the TV set and see Japan in 1670 solving its deforestation problems. Or conversely, we have the media, and our other great advantage is we've got our archaeologists. We know about the societies in the past that failed or succeeded. But again, the Easter Islanders, when they chopped down the last tree in 1670, didn't have their archaeologists to tell them that the Maya had messed up 850 years ago, and that the New Guinea Highlanders had succeeded 700 years ago. So because of you and archaeologists, I'm cautiously hopeful.
Oh, good. So will I be then. You worked on this book for quite a while. How many years in the making?
I began the book in 1998, and I handed in the manuscript on December 13th, 2003, 24 hours ahead of the deadline, to the utter astonishment of my editor.
That long-term thinking and anticipatory.
Yes.
How did it evolve in the course of the writing? And I could imagine there'd be two ways. One, because of things you learned about the past, or things that changed about the present.
The book evolved because of what I learned about the past and about the present. Initially, the book was going to be a book on societies that had collapsed in the past. And I still have my first outline. It's dreadful. 16 chapters on 16 societies, all of which collapsed. God, who wants to read about that? Eventually, I woke up and said, who wants to read about that? And in addition, I realized that it's not the case that all societies in the past have collapsed. There are societies that solved their problems. So the next outline was eight past societies that collapsed and eight past societies that succeeded. And then I realized that that's not enough, because there are societies to... I've got these children. I've got my kids who are now nearly 18 years old. Day after tomorrow, they'll be 18 years old. And they're going to be alive 30 years from now. And whether they're in a world worth living in depends upon whether we solve the problems that undid the Maya.
And eight failing and eight succeeding is just a 50-50 shot.
That's not
better than that.
That's not good enough. And so half the book, I decided, is going to be about present societies, some of which messed up in awful ways. Rwanda messed up, solved its overpopulation problems in this dreadful way of genocide. Haiti has messed up, the poorest country in the New World, massively deforested, 99% deforested. I don't want the United States to end up like Rwanda or Haiti, but there were also modern societies that are doing rather well. So, in short, this book that in 1998 was going to have 16 chapters on 16 past failures ended up as a book half on the past, half on the present, and it's about not only the failures but also the success stories.
And I know that it was originally called Ecocide, or at some point was called Ecocide, ECO, and then side, like suicide, homicide, and so on. Why did you change it?
Ecocide, ecological suicide, I changed it because the book is not just about ecological suicide, it's about ecological success, namely societies that solve their ecological problems. In addition, ecocide, when you're buying a book, who on earth, I mean, it's life is bad enough as it is. Why do I have to pay money to buy a book?
And you certainly
about
wouldn't give it as a gift.
Story?
Here, Pop.
Here, my beloved, here's a nice uplifting book for Christmas, Ecocide.
Wait, I want to ask one last question, because it keeps coming up. In many of the failures, it's climate change. And the climate change we face now is global warming. Yet there are skeptics. There is a constituency that questions that. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I've thoughts about that. 30 years ago, climatologists and scientists themselves were undecided about global warming because the evidence was not convincing. And over the last 30 years, the evidence has become more and more overwhelming, until within the last few years, every knowledgeable scientist and climatologist agrees, yes, there is global warming. We're not sure whether, at the rate we're going now, the world is going to be 1.5 degrees warmer or 5 degrees warmer several decades from now. There's still disagreement about the amount of global warming, but every knowledgeable person agrees that there is global warming. There are also plenty of unknowledgeable people who disagree about global warming, just as there are unknowledgeable people who say, no, the world is not round, the world is flat. And there are also unknowledgeable people who say, no, it's not the case that plants and animals evolved over a long time. Plants and animals were created, bang, 6,000 years ago. Yes, there are non-scientists who believe in foolish things, and that's the case for global warming, just as it's the case for the world being round.
One of the key values you say we need is long-term thinking. And it seems to me that one of the good ways to approach long-term thinking is to imagine or visualize ourselves in the future and look back. So if you were to place yourself, Jared Diamond, at 2020 or 2025, and you look back, did humanity turn things around? And if we did, how did it happen?
Let's place myself, because I'm now 67 and my sons are about to be 18, my twin sons, and I was nearly 50 when my twin sons were born. Let me fast forward 50 years to the year 2055, when my twin sons will be the age that I am today. And instead of asking what is the worst case scenario, which is a world, a whole world like Rwanda, let's ask what's the best case scenario. That would be, looking back from 2055, my sons at my present age would say, around the year 2005, finally enough people began to be concerned about our problems that the balance tipped towards solving the problems instead of ignoring them. And so not just Americans, but Europeans and Japanese and the people of the Philippines and Solomon Islands and Dominican Republic, people around the world concluded, yeah, our population problems are serious. We have to halt the world's population growth. We have to halt global warming or it will do us in. We can't go on mining the world's topsoil and forests the way we are mining the world's coal supplies. We have to reduce our energy consumption, and we have to switch away from fossil fuels towards wind and solar and nuclear and cleaner fossil fuels. We got to do it fast. We got to deal with the world's water problems, not by having wars between Syria and Turkey, but by conserving water. And my sons will look back in the year 2055 and say, yeah, there was some kicking and screaming, and there were people who didn't want to do it, and there were setbacks, but we finally did it. And now in the year 2055, we're in a world worth living in. We've essentially solved our population problems. We've halted the increase of global warming. We have a rational energy policy. And Max and Joshua Diamond, sons of Jared Diamond, deceased long in the past, this is a world worth living in. And our children, the grandchildren of Jared Diamond, can look forward to a world worth living in. That's my best case scenario.
Thank you, Jared Diamond. Thank you for sharing it with us.
You're welcome.
And keep up the good work.
So again, the book is Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed. Thank you to Maggie Bapique, my engineer, Mark Maxwell and Stan Mizrahi in production, to Matt Perez in traffic, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week. To learn more about the show, guests, podcasts, articles, and so on, you can visit me at terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or A World That Just Might Work, all one word, aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. You can listen to podcasts there at iTunes. You can sign up there at iTunes to have the podcast delivered to you weekly. You can also sign up there or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com, to get my weekly email telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and three or four articles of background. You can also check out Free Forum with Terrence McNally on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. You've been listening to Free Forum. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hello, I'm Casey Hobbs.
And I'm Shane Mason, and we're the hosts of Nurse Talk Radio.
Here's what we're talking about this week. Okay, so why is acid reflux so difficult for pediatricians to diagnose? Are they're just not looking for it? Because I know with the, you know, fast food diet and soda, this is a relatively new in the last 20, 30 years. Is that one of the reasons? Why is it that it's not on their radar to look for this?
Well, they don't know how to look for it. First of all, the gastroenterologist stick a scope or a tube down in the esophagus, and that doesn't tell you whether you've got reflux or not. It just tells you whether you've got esophageal disease. And so the pediatrician doesn't have the ability to do a really comprehensive throat examination. And even ENTs, many of them have not been trained to recognize a respiratory reflux, a reflux in the respiratory tract. So this is an area that requires parents to sort of wise up, think about this. Gee, my kid's not getting better on the asthma medication. Gee, my kid's nose has been congested for the last 2 years. The allergy medication doesn't seem to help. In this particular book, there are two quizzes that parents can take, and it determines whether they have likely reflux in their child or not. And then there's what I call the bad reflux diet quiz, and you can fill in what your child eats and whether it's likely to be a contributing factor.
Well, Jamie, it sounds like you have to educate parents so that the parents can ask the questions of the pediatrician.
Thanks for listening. You can find more information about these topics at nursetalksite.com or nationalnursesunited.org.
This podcast is powered by National Nurses United, the nation's largest union for registered nurses.